From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, which is becoming the most connected community in the world based upon this culture of love, right? Helping one another, helping your fellow entrepreneur. And it's starting to click. And so we have a man in here today by the name of Jordan Darling. And in some ways, he's a blast from the past, even though he's a young guy. What are you, like 32, 33 years old now? 33 years old, young guy. A lot of success in entrepreneurship. I want to do a little bit of reminiscing, but maybe I'll kind of set up the show today. We'll do a little reminiscing about him building really successful companies here in our region, and now what he's building, of course. So we're going to talk a little bit about the business that he is building. But I also want to do a little bit of talk about entrepreneurship in general, because you're somebody, I think, that understands the power of entrepreneurship. At 33, I want to talk about the impact it's made on your life and maybe what you've seen with other people as well. And I think really get people thinking about why entrepreneurship is so important. And then maybe a little bit about fatherhood, because we're just sharing, you're talking about your two little kids, and you're raising them in a generation where their world might look a little different than where you grew up. You know, you're a little younger than my kids, but definitely a lot different than the way I grew up. And how do you keep them grounded in what you're doing with those guys? So with that said, Jordan Darling, I met you. You were one of the first guests on the Mark Haney Show 10 years ago. So we just celebrating our 10-year anniversary. And I remember you and I talked on the phone, and I'm like, okay, yeah, let's talk and see about having you come on the show. And I said, you want to meet at my office, your office, or on the water? Because you were building the first electric jet ski known to man. And so we got introduced to you by, I think, GSAC at the time. Yep. And I wanted to get you on my show, but let's meet. We went on the water, and you were building this really cool jet ski. So a lot has happened since then.
It's been a while, yeah.
It has. So in terms of reminiscing, what do you remember from that first meeting? And then let's talk about what happened with Freeform to start off with, because it's a very interesting story. You were my first angel investment.
That's right. Yeah.
So let's see if our memories align on this.
They do, yeah. So I was brand new to the Sacramento region, didn't know many people. I had family in town, Ken Talla, who I think you've done some investing with, and we were just kind of trying to get grounded into Sacramento, and through GSAC, we got connected to the entrepreneur community, which started with Mark Haney. And we met out in the water. I think you rode the jet ski, and then your son Marcus rode it.
I barely rode the jet ski. I was like, it was one of these stand-up jet skis, and you like lifted it out of your truck. With your own, it was so lightweight.
Yep.
I was surprised you just lifted it in there, and then it's like, oh, now I love water sports, but
it's different.
It's different than one of those sit-down jet skis.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys rode it. We had a good time. I think we talked some shops and business, and you ended up making, it sounds like, the first investment, which was pretty exciting.
Yeah, you said something about, I said, oh, are you taking investors? Because it was the first electric jet ski, and you were making it out of this super lightweight
plastic material,
plastic yep. type stuff. And I'm like, you going to do take investors? He's like, yeah, I think so. So I wrote like a $25,000 check in. My first, I own some businesses, but I don't think I ever invested into a company as like a, you know, you take like a little fraction of a share or whatever, fraction of a percent. And then it was, you had success.
Yeah, it worked out pretty good. It was pretty early when you came in. It was kind of our first real fundraising round. You came in with a lot of other people in Sacramento. A lot of it was just bootstrapped. It was my first company, real company, and was just trying to, you know, figure out the best way to take it from an idea to a world-changing idea. And we were fortunate to build a network of other like-minded entrepreneurs and some smart investors in the Sacramento region, and use that capital to turn it from prototypes to kind of take it to the next level, which was to take our technology and expand it out of a boutique, you know, jet ski building business to the world's first electric watercraft. So we used the little bit of investment capital we raised here in town to take the idea and bring it to market. And that quickly evolved from, you know, what's to build a production facility and sell these jet skis around the world to the company getting acquired in a matter of months. So that was a large,
that was cool,
fast changing event.
That was really cool. And so, you know, you were the first one. So I think because of working with you and the fun that we had had, it was just made, you made it a real fun experience. And you did like a little media production. I got to go hang out with you guys and get into a little media production. It was just a fun experience and maybe start doing a little bit more. But so you guys got bought by Nikola, which ended up going public. And then they ran into, I'll call it drama for lack of a better term, due to the founder being accused of this and that, Trevor Milton. Yeah. And obviously from there, the company hasn't done well. And so, what was that experience like, seeing getting acquired and then maybe even seeing what you had sold to them and were helping build kind of begin to crumble as Trevor had his challenges? What was that?
That's a good way
like?
To put it. Yeah. I would say it was an experience you couldn't pay for. So a lot of entrepreneurship is not something you can go read a book about or learn at school. So for me, it was a very, very strong education. I learned a lot about what works well in business, the power of partnership. That was one thing that Trevor was very good at, is he surrounded Nikola and the company with some of the best partners in the world. Bosch, one of the largest automotive brands in the world. Hanwha, very good technology, large capital partner. And that was just to name a few. So the power of partnership was what kind of made Nikola the way it was. But I also learned a lot what not to do. So I had the opportunity to be immersed in a very, very fast growing company. I was employee number 20 when they bought the company. When I left, there were over 2,000. Wow. And that was in less than 4 years. So the company grew a lot. We had to go from a startup phase to a publicly traded company. So that transition was very eye opening. A lot of changes in how businesses ran, with processes and utilizing different tools and building teams and how you manage people and the hiring and the firing at massive scale. So for me, it was, in the end, it was a worthwhile experience. It definitely didn't go the way we anticipated. The nice part was, is a lot of the investors in my company did get good ROIs from it, which, you know, was a positive. But the negative for me was it not being able to kind of bring my idea to fruition and be a part of the change in the industry of power sports. However, you know, indirectly, you know, we did lead the way and kind of push other larger brands to go into electrification. And you'll see that today with a lot of electric power sports in the off-road space and a lot of newcomers in the electric watercraft space. So it's nice to be a part of that kind of change, but was hoping to be leading it from the front and not just kind of jumpstarting the industry.
Do you think Trevor Milton was treated unfairly?
I don't like to get into it too much, but the big thing there for me is I know he's a good person. He cared a lot about his people.
Yeah.
And that, you know, regardless of what he did right or wrong, that was still true. I think the big thing with entrepreneurship, and we see this a lot with a lot of the, you know, famous world-changing entrepreneurs, you could call them, in our world today, where sometimes their excitement gets ahead of reality. And even though things are in motion, they like to talk about them before they happen. I'm a true believer in let the product and the product speak for itself, or let your work speak for itself. Don't talk about what you're going to do. Just do it. That's how I work and that's how I live. So there were some, you know, differences between me and him there. But, you know, in the end, you know, the product was real. The product was the first of its kind. I mean, I've driven in the vehicles. I've sat in the vehicles. I've watched them build. I worked closely with the people that worked on that stuff. For me, I was kind of siloed into the power sports space and heads down focusing what I was doing. So there's other things definitely happening around me, but the people were real. The products were real.
That's,
you know,
good.
Everything was
That's
in motion.
Good to know, 'cause I believed in him and the, and it seemed to me from obviously a distance that some of the things were sort of unfair, that he got, you know, he got a lot of bad press and things like that, but I thought he seemed like a good guy. And so I was really disappointed on how it went. Obviously, it was bad for the stock. But then the Trump administration, from what I understand, it pardoned him for anything that he may or may not have done, and in over-promoting the product or whatever it was. So that's good to know. And I'm glad he's seems like he's turned his stuff around.
Yeah. And it's like I said, it's entrepreneurship is a lonely business for sure. And the cool thing about kind of everything that happened there is, the team definitely stayed together for me. As the company evolved, power sports was becoming more of a distraction than a priority for the business. So for me, My passion was in power sports. My passion was in semi trucks. So if I couldn't work on, you know, what I was there for and what I originally built, then there wasn't really a place for me there. So I was, you know, allowed at least to have the opportunity to transition all of my team to new roles, which was nice. And then I was the last one there, if you will, in the power sports, shut the lights off, walked out, never looked back. So for me, it was bittersweet to kind of leave what I built behind. I don't think any of it will really turn into anything, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. They dispersed the assets when the company officially filed bankruptcy. So there's new owners for different things, and you know the IP and the technology still exists. It's just not mine anymore. So it's you know, like I said, I look at it back as it was an education you couldn't buy, and I'm you know taking what I learned, right, wrong, or indifferent, and applying that to the new companies I'm building today.
That's great. Well, let's get into some of those companies, and then we'll talk about just the power of entrepreneurship. So maybe the one company that I am more familiar with, the Growth Factory, is actually making an investment into, and it looks like a really cool product that's going to be really potentially disruptive in the building industry. Maybe tell us about Superseed.
Yeah, so Superseed is an idea that we took kind of out of the notebook to real life about 4 years ago. So the problem that we're trying to solve is the building materials industry has evolved more in the sense of how homes are built, how buildings are built, but the materials used in it have kind of the same over the last 100 years. The big piece that we're trying to disrupt is wood used in construction. So structural lumber that we're attacking is in the sheathing market, traditionally known as oriented strand board, OSB, and plywood. The product itself, wood being OSB and plywood, has not changed in its dimensions, but the wood that's being utilized is rapidly changing. So the wood that, you know, was used to build homes 20 years ago is not what it is today. It's much younger trees, which has a drastic effect on performance. And so houses are getting bigger, houses are getting more complex, buildings are getting bigger, buildings are getting more complex, but the materials being used are still the same or worse than what they once were.
So are they becoming warped faster, things like that?
Yeah. Less dimensionally stable, more negative effects with moisture. The strength is actually more affected with changing in temperatures, changing in moisture content. So it's just not what it used to be. So for us, we wanted to come into the construction market, the building materials market, with a better product that, you know, outperforms OSB and plywood, but also does better for the world. So the one thing that I felt when I left the power sports world was I had some unfinished business to do better in this world. So I wanted to build companies that had a global impact. And the one big thing that North America, you know, lacks in sufficiently is in recycling. So we have a large plastic waste problem. In the U.S. alone, we recycle less than 10% of the plastic waste we generate, and it either goes into a landfill or gets shipped overseas and eventually spills into the ocean. So for me, I was trying to look at, we have two problems here. We have a tremendous amount of plastic waste that doesn't have a home, and we have building materials that are underperforming where, you know, they should be. So we try to take both of those problem statements, put them together, and that's how we, you know, developed this new product, which is we started in the market with called the Marine Board. It's a direct replacement for marine-grade plywood. Marine-grade plywood is traditionally used in wet environments, whether that's building vehicles like boats, building RVs, or building construction.
If you're watching on YouTube, it really is the dimensions of a piece of plywood, basically. It's just a quarter-inch plywood, right?
Yeah. That's half-inch.
Or half-inch plywood, yeah. So this is, it feels like a piece of plywood, except for it's
hollow.
Yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah, so there's a lot of engineering that went into it. We've invented and patented the manufacturing process. We've worked with a lot of suppliers around the world to develop a proprietary formulation that works, because the one advantage wood has is it's half the density of plastic. So you get the same amount of performance for half the weight if it was solid piece to solid piece. So the team and I developed this hollow profile.
Oh, is this lighter than a piece of plywood?
It's the same weight.
Oh, that's what I was thinking.
There's some that are heavier for sure and that we're lighter in, but you know, if you average that across the board, the goal is 1-to-1 on weight, 1-to-1 on performance. But there's several areas where we're stronger, several areas we have better fastener retention. There's a lot of other advantages, the main being that it's inherently waterproof.
Well, okay, so maybe I'll dive into a couple of pieces of the why a little bit. So we're cutting down trees. Are there people out there in the world that don't want us to cut down as many trees too? Is there kind of a movement to like, hey, man?
Yeah, I think it's a global movement. I mean, some people aren't aware of it. If they're not, you know, in the areas that are being affected by it. In Arizona, I take my son camping up into the hills, and, you know, a lot of spots we camping are logging trails now. And you can literally watch these old growth forests being mowed down just to produce lumber. And those, you know, old growth forests takes hundreds and hundreds of years to generate. It's not something that he or I are going to see in our lifetime. So deforestation is real. It's a problem. The New York Times just did a very powerful article about 2 weeks ago talking about some of the tropical rainforests that are being mowed down to build materials for the RV industry. So it had nothing to do with the article, but it told pretty much our story and it talked a lot of our why in the deforestation, where this wood that they use to build vehicles called Luan is from old growth trees in tropical rainforests. And those rainforests are being mowed down, you know, affecting the ecosystem around them to, in essence, build building materials. And yeah, that's how it's been. That doesn't mean it's right. So for us, it's like, this is a new engineered product that takes a tremendous amount of waste. There's an abundance of it. If the entire industry switched over to our product, there would still be enough recycled plastic left to serve our industry. So we have a tremendous amount of waste. We can stop cutting down trees, avoid filling landfills, and in the end, build a better product.
Wow. And then the other why that I think jumped out at me when we talked about this last was that this is fire retardant. Is that the right word? This is not going to burn up like a piece of plywood?
It can be, yeah. So the cool thing about the manufacturing process is we can extrude multiple materials at the same time. So this base product here, the target is RVs and trailers. So there does different building codes, or fraction isn't any building codes. But for certain housing markets like California, if there's high fire regions, we can actually extrude a secondary polymer on the top and bottom of this to make it fireproof. And that's kind of the cool thing with this is, it's not a, it can be a one size fits all, meaning it's the same machine, the same manufacturing process. We can just turn on different levers to make different products for different applications.
Okay. So you decided to start in the marine area, watercraft, but your bigger strategy is the building industry, houses, and people that are using a lot of plywood for now.
Correct.
I mean, I would say that's the, eventually you're going to get into that market.
Yes. Yeah. So when we started this, the intent was full speed into construction. So myself and one of the co-founders, Shane, spent tremendous amount of time, Shane especially, on developing what's called an accreditation with the International Code Council. So the International Code Council is the governing body for building materials, run by the lumber guys. So you have a non-lumber company coming in here. There's a lot of resistance to get through. But, you know, to Shane's pat on Shane's back, he got it done. And we got the product, with our own accreditation for this building material. And then we got the list of the tests that we had to run. So we were full steam ahead going into construction. And then the lumber crisis, the results of the lumber crisis of COVID happened, where the biggest impacts were seen, obviously, in the building industry, where there was a massive spike in cost of building materials. But where it was seen the biggest was in the RV and boats. And they have a much smaller pool of materials to buy from, specifically the treated stuff. So we saw that as an immediate opportunity to kind of prove our technology, where it's going to be in the worst conditions. It's getting bounced down the road. It's getting smashed on waves in the ocean. So it's like, why not test a building material that's going to be in a fixed structure in a vehicle that's going to see the most abuse? Because if it works in a boat on the ocean, or it works in an RV that's getting trailer across country, then we know it's going to work just fine in a house.
That's interesting that you kind of went back into the watercraft arena, knowing that you had already built a company in that space. But yeah. Is that... I guess size of market smaller than the housing market, I assume?
Much smaller, yeah. But the interesting thing there is it allows us to, you know, it's a perfect starting place, one, to prove the product, but two, to allow us to find opportunities to lower our costs. So marine grade plywood is multiples more expensive than your traditional building material. So allowed us to enter a market where, you know, we're still working on reducing our costs, still have healthy margins to build a business, because, you know, the only key part of keeping a business alive is, you know, making money. So how can we build a good product while still making good money? Mm-hmm. So we jumped into this industry, disrupting it where they had an issue. They have a tremendous amount of supply chain problems. The wood is failing. And these manufacturers are, you know, you could say, trying to make their vehicles better by how can we engineer wood out of the equation? And the alternatives are not cost effective to make that easy. So the traditional alternatives in the wood industry are 300 to 400% more than the wood they're trying to replace. And anyone that's trying to run a business knows that, you know, your bill of materials can't necessarily absorb that type of an impact, where when we are coming into this, we're, you know, either add a one-to-one cost of the wood they're trying to replace, depending on their volumes, or a slight premium, and it's a better product. So it's a much easier pill to swallow for these manufacturers.
It makes sense. No, so I have a, I still have that G23 Nautique. We need to use it more.
Yep.
Does that have a lot of wood in it, or what?
It does.
It does? You can't see the wood. Where's the wood?
You wouldn't know it, but you have the wood in your floors, you have wood in your seats, wood in all your hatches, and then they just encapsulate it in fiberglass. But the problem is, you know, boat's moving, it's flexing, there's a lot of forces, stuff moves, water will find its way in, and you'll find over time, a lot of boats, you'll see people redecking them or getting them fixed. Hmm. A lot of things they're replacing is the rotten wood.
Is it getting rotten because it's getting wet?
It's because it's getting wet. Mm, yep. So okay. It's treated, and they treat it with some nasty chemicals. They started back in the day with copper arsenic combination, and they found that, you know, arsenic's really not a good thing to be out in the water. So over time, they've worked on how can we change the chemical composition of this treatment we're putting in this wood to make it better. So they started using more copper and other metals, which they found also reacts with salt water and aluminum and can sometimes dissolve your metal boat. So there's a lot of weird things that happen in the wood industry to try to make their product more termite proof or waterproof. But in the end, you know, our thought is why to try to make it harder? Why don't you just use something that's inherently waterproof that performs the same or better, and then your problems are solved. And that's where we come in.
Very cool. And so now you're having to, so you built the prototypes, and are you building out a factory today?
Yes, we have our headquarters is in Phoenix, Arizona. Today, we have one extrusion line in operation and one pelletizing line. The extrusion line is what makes the board, and the pelletizing line is what makes the material. We have our second extrusion line is currently on its way from our manufacturer. That'll arrive in the next 45 days. So we're doubling our capacity next month. And then we've already ordered and are building our second factory, which is in the Midwest. And that second factory is a little over 2 times the size of our headquarters. So and the reason for that is capacity. So we're fortunate when we launched this business October of last year that we've built a sales pipeline north of $60 million. And that's just in the RV and the boat industry. And for that, it's now we just have to build capacity. And these sales cycles, you know, take, you know, 6 to 7 months typically when you start with these big OEMs mm-hmm. to go from the initial test to a contract. And we started that process, you know, a while ago, and now we're getting to starting to lock in and close those contracts. So now we have to continue to build more capacity and continue to build more factories. So our second factory is kind of the blueprint of what the future factories will be. Our first factory in Phoenix kind of was our prototype, if you will, of we can prove that we can make it. And then in that factory, we prove that we could sell it. And now the second factory is to prove that we can scale it. So in essence, we look at our factories of the future of best in pairs. So two extrusion lines with one pelletizing line, mm-hmm. and then you can scale it from there. And the cool thing about our business that is not very common in the manufacturing space is how capital efficient our equipment is. So traditionally, you have to, you know, spend many, many years to pay back your equipment, when we can pay it back in 1 year.
Wow, that's impressive. Just out of the profits of the sales of the product. Okay.
Correct.
Very cool. And on building factories, we don't have a lot of manufacturers come on the show, but we hear now a lot of talk about automation with factories. And obviously, you've got really systematized. How are you thinking about the use of, I guess, automation in the future and robotics and things like that? Are they part of the equation?
Yeah, huge part. So when we built the first factory, we were just kind of starting with what was commercially available. And myself and one of the other co-founders, Shane, kind of just spent better part of 6 months learning the machine, learning how it works, what doesn't, and what are the areas we can improve. And that was just with the two of us running the machine. And then as time's gone on, we've, you know, worked ourselves off of the line and brought in employees, so manufacturing employees that are now taking what we've learned, taking our process, in essence, our manual, and now they're running the machine. And now we sit back and we watch them. What's working? What's not? What's a pain point? What's easy for them to do? What's not easy for them to do? What are the areas that they're spending too much time doing that they should be doing somewhere else? And that's where we then, you know, with our process engineers and others, we start developing ways to how can we automate that process and how can we allow them to spend more time doing what they're doing? So the engineering team has developed several different things that have removed people from doing different jobs on this line. And our goal for the next, say, 12 months is continue to improve that. So our first machine was, you can essentially say, the dumb machine. Our second machine had about 20 to 25% improvements in automation. So in essence, reducing the amount of manpower needed on that machine by introducing technologies or smart valves or computers or other things to kind of take away from the work that the employee has to do. And then on our, for our new factory, so lines 3, 4, 5, and 6 that we ordered, they even have further levels of automation, meaning the machine can do more than what is required from the early machines we've bought. We've now, you know, spent the money to upgrade the earlier machines, so they're all up into the same spot. And then what we're looking to do on our factory number 3 is try to get as close to a lights out factory as possible, meaning we'll have a set team that will start the machines, get the material moving down the line, and once the machine is at a steady state, they can walk away and the machine just runs. And then in essence, you just have people babysitting to ensure that, you know, things can happen, things can break. Their job is to fix it, restart, get it to steady state again. And then that is where we can tremendously scale, continue to reduce our cost of goods, particularly labor, mm-hmm. and then continue to find ways to automate more.
It makes me think about, if you ever read the book, I think it's called The Goal. It's a story it's like a fictional story, and I think it takes place around a factory, but it uses this reference of this one kid that's on a hike on this, I guess it's like a Boy Scout camping trip or something, and he's holding up the hike because he falls back, he keeps falling back in line, so he's the problem in automating this hike. And so they determine that, you know, they need to lighten up his pack and, you know, make it so that he can stay up and kind of take away, you know, minimize the weakest link, if you will. And as I think about building a factory, I'm thinking about, you're so analytical that you, I mean, I'm dumbing it down for myself, like I'm talking to a fourth grader, but I have to imagine with your mind, you are looking at things like almost on like a real-time basis to figure out how to throw more product in, you know, build more product, build more boat material, and that you're going to just like, you're the perfect guy for this.
Yeah. And I can't take all the credit for it. Like I said, we have an incredible team. And as I've talked to you before, the cool thing about it is I get to do it with some of my closest friends, and some of them are much smarter than me. So we've got a strong team, and they are all working towards the same goal. So we look at it in essence, pounds per hour or kilograms per hour. So how many pounds of material per hour can we process through the line? And then the next piece that we're looking at is how many boards per hour, and then how many boards per length of machine. So today our machine sits at 90 feet long. What we're trying to do is we're trying to move as many of the processes in that 90 feet, or in, say, if we need to make it a little longer, in that 100 feet space. So we can go from our raw material to our final product out the door in the shortest period of time. So that's the big advantage we have over the lumber and the lumber companies and the lumber alternatives, is we can do so much with so little space. Our factory is, to make it simple, is 1/100th of the size of what a traditional lumber factory is. So that makes us much more advantageous to be co-located with some of our big customers, or be able to be closer to the final destination of where the product's going to go, kind of further reducing the logistics. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing is, going back to the automation, is the more we can fit in a certain amount of space, the more efficient we can be, the more we can lower our costs. And everything comes down to the cost of our board. So the lower we can get the cost of our board, the more markets that we can jump into, which, you know, the big one being construction.
Oh, wow. Love it. I hadn't thought about co-locating on site with a boat manufacturer,
correct,
potentially.
Which a lumber company couldn't do. Mm-hmm. So the cool thing for us is, if, you know, our machines, you know, can produce, depending on the size of the board and the thickness, call it around 80,000 boards a year per machine.
Yeah. And that's going to take, obviously, moving the product around is reduced pricing there.
Yep.
And maybe just rent. Just in time. So it really...
a lot of efficiencies.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And allow them to be more control of their supply chain, because a lot of the pain points that they ran into from COVID is, the positive thing for COVID is everyone was buying boats and RVs. The negative part of COVID for them is their supply chain wasn't ready for that massive increase in demand. They just couldn't support it. They tried. So the lumber companies tried cranking up production. Well, they weren't ready. So they had failures. They fell short. They made mistakes. They still delivered the product. The manufacturers put it in anyway. Come to find out there was an issue. And then that continued to snowball. And that was a very costly mistake for a lot of them.
Yeah, and from a cash flow perspective, if they don't have to sit on a bunch of inventory, you know, a bunch of wood, if you will, and, you know, got to pay for it, you basically, I got an order for a boat, I could build one potentially.
Correct.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so you have another company that you're building too that I don't really know about as much. Maybe tell us about that company. You're building two companies simultaneously?
Yeah.
Okay. How does that work?
So when I took time off from, you could say, my first kind of real career, I had a lot of ideas. And I was, I guess, convincing enough to convince two of my friends who followed me at different ventures in the past to quit their jobs, some of which I put them in, and come join me and just, in essence, hang out in my pool house. And figure out, okay, how can we take these ideas I have? I'll pay you and help me take these ideas and let's try to turn them into companies.
I remember you telling me about, I don't know, 50 or 100 ideas. Yeah. You had like a lot of ideas.
I had a lot of ideas. So a lot of them actually were from college. So another friend who's the CEO of Superseed, the other founder, he and I made a PowerPoint when we were in college of all these different ideas because we both started our first companies in college together. And over the years, we've kind of watched some of them come to fruition. So it was like, it's cool to see like some of the world-changing ideas that we had, you know, almost a decade ago or more come to life today. But some of those we tried making companies for. But the two that stuck, one was Superseed, which is the lumber company. The other one was a donut company called Dupe Loops. So,
oh, yeah.
It's more of a passion business. It's a fun business. Yeah. For me, I have a lot of food allergies and growing up, you know, I love donuts. One of my dad's close friends owned a lot of Dunkin' Donuts. So I had, you know, VIP access to fresh donuts, what they used to be at Dunkin' Donuts, now what they are today. And I love donuts. So when I got these food allergies, you know, forever, I just couldn't enjoy a donut. And now I'm bored. You know, I don't have a job necessarily. So I'm starting these companies and I was like, let's make a donut company. I'm sick of not being able to say yes to having a donut. So took the crazy idea and started making recipes in our kitchen. Thankfully, my wife Jill is a good cook and, you know, we brought in some pastry chefs and they kind of helped with some of the recipes. And then we actually got to something that we felt was pretty spectacular. So we did some tests and allowed some other people to taste it. People couldn't believe us that it was what it was. We're like, all right, we have a product here. How can we bring this to market?
So it's like a deep fried product though. You
the original
make it
one was.
Okay.
Yeah. The original one was, is like, we don't want to ruin the fidelity of a donut. So right. It's like a donut, you know, in the fashion that we started with needs to be fried, but how can we make this accessible to people like me or my kids that, or my wife that have all these food allergies. So we made a gluten, dairy, soy, nut-free donut with clean ingredients, no dyes, no preservatives. That was proofed fried like a regular donut. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like, all right, I don't really want to open a donut shop. Let's try to do something more fun and different. And obviously I knew a thing or two about building vehicles. So we're like, all right, let's build a mobile donut shop with the craziest, most state-of-the-art donut truck you've ever seen. So went and bought a brand new, biggest Freightliner box truck you could buy. And then myself and the co-founder of Dupe Loops, Brendan, we in essence designed a mobile donut factory on wheels. So
wow.
I sourced a donut robot. So it was invented by the gentleman who made all the robots for a company called Belshaw, which is used in like Krispy Kreme, the ones you see in the window. So we got a miniature version of that. We cut the side of the truck out, stuffed it inside of our truck, in essence built a donut assembly line inside mm-hmm. a vehicle. So raw ingredients started on one end, went into this donut robot. It proofed the donut through an oven conveyor belt system that came out when the donut was risen, ready to go, put it into a fryer, fried one side, flipped it, fried the other side. The donut comes out of the fryer, turns right, and now is going into a dryer. And then the employees would decorate the donuts and then fresh donuts out the window. So we in essence created a state-of-the-art donut operation on wheels that you could drive anywhere you want and sell donuts. So we did that for about a year. We launched that probably 2.5 years ago and we were selling out every single time within 2 hours. We couldn't keep up with the demand. The product was incredible. We had 18 flavors. We would cycle the flavors every weekend. We had a separate operation, which was our commissary, where we had a kitchen that we made the donut blanks and all the ingredients, stuffed it in the truck. And the truck goes on different locations and would just sell products. So we saw the demand for, you know, an allergen-free donut, and my goal was like, I want to get this to as many people as possible. And I came to kind of a crossroads where do I try to scale this food truck business or do we try to go wholesale? If I go wholesale, meaning, you know, try to get a product shelf stable, to try to get it into grocery stores, to try to get it to the masses. So Looking at the wholesale route, it's like, all right, we need to put in some serious capital. I've already invested a tremendous amount of money in this brand and this food truck and this operation. You know, maybe we'll go raise some capital. Maybe I'll put more in and we'll go wholesale. And then going back to earlier, the power of partnership, then I came up with this, like, hey, I just met this guy recently who's a successful snack business. You know, we've become good friends. Let me reach out to him and see if there's a good partnership here. We're already working together a little bit. You know, his team was advising me on some of the different growth opportunities and the recipes. We're working on refining it. And I pitched him the idea and he's like, he was in love with it. So I partnered with a company called Heavenly Hunks, which is a snack company. You've probably seen at Costco. They're at Rayleigh's. They're okay. It's a healthy little granola snack. They have probably 15 or 20 different flavors. They've been going on for about a decade now. It's probably one of the top selling products at Costco.
Oh, wow.
But it's a healthy snack ingredient. And we partnered up. So they're our partner in this joint venture and they're helping bring Doop Loops to Minnie Mouse around the country.
Okay. So it'll be a packaged product then, prepackaged, but not necessarily fresh.
Yeah. So it's a naturally shelf stable. I don't want to say too much about it yet because it's not launched yet, but it's a naturally shelf stable donut that'll be readily available at stores.
Wow. That's exciting. Okay, so you're doing that in your extra time there on building a donut company. And it made me think about all your ideas for a second, too, and just to mention, did you know we're building in a venture studio into the Growth Factory?
No, I didn't.
So we are going to be building companies within the Growth Factory as well as making investments that are more traditional as a early stage investor or VC. But we partnered with Ollie McEnany. He's been on the show a couple of times. And so he's built a venture studio and launched a company or two out of that. And he's really early and we're a new entity. So we just brought him on as an equity partner into the Growth Factory. And we're going to be part of the Growth Factory effort, a venture studio. And so we are going to be taking ideas and actually building out companies. So Brilliant. If you have any that... I'll introduce them to you at the Best of the Backyard party, but I just imagine that with your ideas or anybody's ideas out there that are really creative, but you're maybe not in position to build another company at the moment, or maybe, you know, but you've got great ideas. We may be able to take a look at some of the best companies and test them out, see if we can turn it into something. So,
yeah, that's awesome. Anyway, yeah. I think it's a great idea. And that's kind of where... I mean, when you have what I call the entrepreneur sickness, it's kind of hard to turn your brain off. And when I was younger, I would just write them down and I had this PowerPoint. Fortunately, the computer died, but I had this PowerPoint that had all these ideas and I would kind of flush them out. And then over time, you know, if I'd get time, I would kind of try to put the effort in to try to turn it into something. But once you kind of get into a rhythm, which is kind of where I'm at now, we're trying to balance, you know, being a present father and husband and trying to have two companies, I don't really have time for anything else. So for me, of course, if any of the ideas I feel are worth something, I think it would be a great, great platform to test them in.
Sounds good. Okay. So let's talk about entrepreneurship then, generally speaking. You called it a sickness. Okay. So walk me through how you developed that and what is that sickness besides creating wealth and, you know, things like that. What are the other sort of symptoms of that condition?
the symptoms is not being able to kind of kick it like a cold.
Okay.
So for me, I think I've had it for probably since I was in high school. It was kind of my first rendition of a business. It was a car detailing operation I did out of my parents' house, which grew into, you know, a group bringing me in along with another kid and, you know, running their cleaning. And then that kind of scaled to getting a real job, being a professional car detailer. So I started that when I was at a young age in high school. And then I kind of tried to say, okay, yeah, car detailing is something I'm good at. You know, I knew how to run a buffer, knew how to do a clay bar, knew how to wet sand, get scratches out, do all that crazy stuff. But this isn't really a passion. So then I tried to, okay, how can I do something that I'm more passionate about, that I love doing, that also makes money? So that's when I got into, I loved watercraft. So I would buy and sell with my dad old jet skis, stand-up jet skis, and I would, you know, fix them up, give them a paint job, put new engines in them, and then sell them for more money. So that kind of, I was able to, in essence, pay for what I liked doing, which was ride jet skis. So I would buy and sell and flip them and continue to be able to fund my lifestyle as a high schooler, which was buying Jeeps and trucks and dirt bikes and whatever else. So that kind of started it. And then that business, you know, like I said, was doing quite well. So I continued actually doing that into college. I bought myself a new truck and was able to have some jet skis to play with myself. So I, you know, went into college with some money in the bank, but I continued to do it in college. So kept buying bigger ones, more expensive ones, a lot more of them, and then kind of was scaling. And then I saw an opportunity to start, you know, I was going to engineering school. So I was like, all right, how can I leverage what I'm learning in engineering and product development to make jet skis better? So that's when I started developing products for jet skis. So I found this component that would always fail, so I would engineer a better one. I found a contract manufacturer, worked with them. They would make the, I would design the product, they would make the product, and then I would pack and ship it. So that was kind of the early days of like Craigslist and eBay and forums, where I was able to kind of make a business, make a living, if you will, and go through college with some money. And then that's when, you know, the, you could say the first big idea came up with, okay, let's build my own jet ski. And that kind of started the kind of a small business on the side to making a genuine company that someone would put money into.
Okay. But the 100 ideas thing is kind of intriguing to me, because, you know, I always wonder what the mind of, like, let's say an Elon Musk or you, or just some of these people that maybe they don't shut it off that much. Like, how, like when I first met you, I remember how many hours a day you work, and you said like 22 hours a day or something. It was in the 20s. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't 24, but it was like 20. And I was like, what? How, what do you mean? Because you had moved out here without Jill at that point. Yeah. And so you, I guess you had time, but where's the sleep? You know, you think about, how does Trump do it? How do people work like that and not shut it off? And then also, how does your mind stay, I'll call it productive, because that's really, I mean, it's a lot.
That's the
you
sickness.
Get tired, right? You
that's
get,
the sickness,
yeah. You, most people just sort of get tired. They think about something too much. Like, I got to shut it off, you know, after an hour, right?
It's constantly going.
You don't do that.
Yeah. So it was two nights ago. One of our dogs was getting sick in the night. So I was up at 2-3 o'clock, and then, you know, usually I can fall right asleep, but then I remembered like, oh, something I got to do tomorrow. And I remembered, you know, I got to talk to the ops team. I want to try this, or we have to go to this supplier. You know, I need to send this email, and then the mind starts going. And then before you know it, you're not going to sleep. So that's when I refer to the sickness is your mind never stops, whether it's thinking of new ideas, or it's thinking what you have to do tomorrow, what you have to accomplish this month, or, you know, what we have to, you know, to commit to. I mean, we're putting, you know, a lot of capital out there right now, spending a lot of money on equipment. So my mind's always going through different scenarios, different business cases. What are other opportunities? How can we grow this? So that's the sickness. So yeah, I would say, you know, going back to it, mind's always racing. That's where, like at a young age when I wasn't really, you could say, focused on a company, that's where I had a lot of time to think. And where the ideas come, at least for me, is when I see problems. So, you know, I experienced something that I didn't like, or I tried a product that, you know, wasn't working well, my mind always looks to, how can I make it better, or how can I solve this problem? And one of the ideas that I'm kind of bummed I didn't have the, you could say, the either the brain power or the money at the time early in college to take to fruition, as I went to a technology school in Rochester, New York, and the school was the largest school for the deaf and blind. So I was, you know, always around, you know, students that were either deaf or blind or both. And I remember, you know, ordering lunch one day, and there was a kid in front of me who was deaf and blind, and he was trying to communicate to the kitchen what he was trying to order. They had no idea. They had no way to communicate to each other. So that's where one of my early inventions, which I patented but didn't have the money to take to the next level, was this communication device that allows the deaf and blind to be able to communicate with people like you and I that don't speak sign language or can't feel Braille or anything like that. And it was called the Mobile Braille Translator. It was, in essence, a smartwatch that would take your voice and convert it to Braille text, so someone that was deaf or blind could read it. So I patented it. You know, the idea was really cool. It didn't exist, but to develop something at that stage, there was no technology out there. There was a lot of things. And, you know, I was, I think, probably 19 years old at the time, so couldn't really do much with it. And then probably 8 years later, someone brought it to market. And that's a product that exists today. And it was something, like I said, that I drafted up. Actually, it's how I met one of my co-founders and the CEO of Superseed. Was I needed patent drawings made, and I had no money. So,
you get any royalties off of that thing? Since they probably use it. Are they using any of your protected stuff?
Yeah, I didn't take it to the. I only paid for the provisional patent. I couldn't get the non-provisionals. I didn't have any money. But the patent drawings are actually drawn by my close friend and CEO of Superseed, Sean, and I traded him lunch at Chipotle for the patent drawings. He was a designer. I had some food.
That's how it's done.
And we got it done.
I love it. So when you have like an idea in the middle of the night, you hear about like Trump texting world leaders at, you know, all hours of the night. If you have an idea that you want to share with somebody real time, but it's off hours. Do you just save it for the next morning to, like, I don't know, 6, 8 in the morning? Or do you just send it, I don't care? Or do you write it down to do tomorrow?
Combination of both, depending on the idea, depending on who that I'm trying to talk to in the world. I got friends all over the world. So if they're up in, you know, Europe or Australia, I'll send the message to them. But I have a pretty sophisticated notes list in my phone of different layers of business ideas and other things. And I just continue to populate that, whether it's goals that I want to achieve or it's different things that I need to achieve or ideas that come up. I'll take a note or I'll send myself an email and then get to it the next day. Yeah.
I use Evernote you can make it really sophisticated or you can leave it kind of basic. But what do you have a certain app on your phone that you use, or you created your own thing?
Apple Notes.
Simple, Apple Notes. Okay.
And it's got a passcode. If anyone tries to steal my phone and steal the ideas, you can't get in. But
yeah, everybody's coming for the phone. Okay, so entrepreneurship, a sickness. I always think of entrepreneurship, and a lot of times you get the negatives of entrepreneurship don't come out that much, but there is a lot of risk that you take. There is a lot of sacrifice. How do you balance that out with the good parts of, like, I love the idea of creating opportunity for people. I love the idea of building something that nobody thought was possible, you know, kind of doing something super unique that's good for the world. Yep. How do you sort of balance, I guess, the stuff that some people might think of as negative, the risk and the sacrifice and, you know, all that stress that can happen with the other?
Very good question. So for me, I look at it as, you know, the amount of risk that someone can take really depends on where they're at in their life. So when I started my first company, it was, you know, I had really nothing to lose. I had some college debt. I didn't really have any commitments. I had a girlfriend at the time who's now my wife. And so it's still, you know, it was a more of a mutual decision, but that's like, what do I have to lose at this point? Yeah, I can go deeper into debt, but whatever, you know, I'm not in my, you know, late teens, early 20s, let's do it. So at a younger age, you know, I could work those 20 to 25 hours if I could find the extra hour in the day, and take that risk because there was less to lose. Starting these new businesses is a little different because now I had a family, you know, I had a wife, I had a house that I owned. When I started my first business, I had a rental property that, you know, rent was whatever it was, $800 a month or something. So the risk then versus now was a lot different, but the difference now is, you know, as you said, you know, building wealth, I was fortunate to do well with the first business. So the hardest part with starting a business, especially at the idea stage, is getting the money to do it. And the risk is the highest at the idea phase and it's the lowest when you're making money. So I was fortunate to be in a position where both of my companies, I was able to start with my own money. So the risk was all mine. Which is very, very different. But I was kind of in a position where, like I said, I was willing to put this money on the line, just like when VC makes a startup investment. You know, 9 times out of 10, it's probably not going to succeed, but that one that succeeds likely will outweigh the 9 that failed. So for me, I believed in myself. I believed in my ideas and my abilities to execute and surrounding myself with people smarter than me. So I put the money on the table and put the risk on the table, if you will, to pursue that idea. But then going back to the other piece with balancing the risk with the other negatives of being an entrepreneur is the home work life balance. And that was something I didn't do good at in the earlier years where I was working the crazy hours, you know, didn't do much with friends, didn't travel much unless it was for work. And, you know, thankfully I was at a time in my life where my girlfriend or fiance or wife, depending on the different phases, was busy as well. But now having kids doing other things, it's much, much different. So when we started these companies, and I say we, because my wife was definitely a part of it, but when we started these companies, the goal was, is we have to have me and the people that I bring in have to have a better home work-life balance. And that's something that we push down, you know, to all different levels of our companies where you have to be able to take the time and recharge. You have to be able to take the time, set those problems aside and come back to them later on to make sure you can be a good husband, a good father, or a good wife, depending on where you're at. And that was something that, still not 100%. We're getting better at it, but that's a key thing of these new companies is being able to have that balance. Because for me, I don't want to, you know, build all of this success and have all of this, but not be a good father. And so I've made it a point to make the time, to take the time off, to go do trips with my family, you know, do stuff that my son loves, be ready for when my daughter's ready to do things, do stuff that she loves, and like take trips with my wife and see friends and see family. And that's kind of been the big change for me because I've seen so many people. Elon Musk is a great example who can change the world, but in the end, if you know, you don't have family, what's the point? So, you know, I'm trying to do it differently now. You know, the reason why I do this is to kind of create that freedom for my family in the future and to keep that freedom we have now. And that's a big thing that I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with, because it's hard to do both. It's hard to create world-changing ideas and be the first at it while still being present for your family, because there's only so much time in the day. But how I've kind of found the ways to do that is empowering the people around me. And I've been fortunate to be able to build these businesses with my closest friends, which, so before I was doing it alone, and now I get to do it with the people I couldn't spend time with because I was building a business. So, you know, I work every single day with my two closest friends at Superseed, and then my newest closest friend is my business partner, my other business. So every day that I'm working on something, I get to be with my friends. When I go home, I'm with my family. So that's kind cool. I feel like I'm winning and successful just because I get to do it with people that I'm close to.
Yeah. Now I know your parents, I know your uncle, you've got great parents. What made your dad a great father?
Being present. Yep. So he worked two jobs as well. He was in the power business and also home building business, but he was still home when I got home from school. He was still there to bring me to hockey practice. He was the coach of the hockey team. So we were together on the weekends traveling and still taking trips, doing snowmobile trips, four-wheeler trips, going out in the water, going to camp. And that was the biggest thing. And I have a lot of friends who are incredibly successful entrepreneurs as well. And that was kind of their biggest regret, is they were working so much that, you know, they didn't get to see their kids grow up. They're now present now. But that was like, when you talk to them, they're like, one thing I would have done differently is been around my kids more. And for me, you know, I was fortunate to meet these people ahead of my kids being old. And I've tried to focus on that as a key element of our business, where we can still make a difference in the world. We can still make incredible companies and still be, you know, a part of our family. And that's kind of the key thing I want to do going forward.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. I think about you all the time, and even though we don't see each other every day, so it's good to definitely see you. See you're doing so well, and in some small way I'm still a part of your life journey and your business journey. So it's really an honor, and you know, I feel a ton of gratitude toward you for helping me develop a little bit of confidence around angel investing. Otherwise, if my first one would have been a dud, I might be out. Now that's what I do for a living, basically. So I appreciate you, man.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.